I'm pretty sure it's come up before that music was pretty much my first reason for using the internet.
Are we talking like piracy music or just music in general music?
I would never do something like that.
Of course not.
Piracy is illegal. pretty much I'm talking about like downloading tens of thousands of songs illegally that I still have.
Are we talking Napster or are we talking before or after?
Napster briefly. Mm-hmm. SoulSeek was actually network that I used.
SoulSeek.
Because it had a great Mac client.
Really?
Yeah. So it was actually like the best software for music piracy.
This was still back in my PC days.
Uh-huh.
This was when I was too young to shell out the money for my own computer, I feel like.
So I guess like I'm thinking about high school. Let me do this chronologically. So we have definitely talked about musician forums.
Yes.
.net or whatever it was.
Right.
The first social network that I participated in. I'm quite sure that that's where I found out about SoulSeek. So I was listening to music pretty religiously already, but exclusively in the form of CDs purchased with allowance or like, you know, ripped from my dad who had a voluminous CD collection. So I got an iMac in high school. It was purchased before that as a shared Mac for me and my brother. But my brother then got another computer, and so I just took the iMac up into my room. So I had my own iMac. I'm pretty sure his was nicer, actually. I think he got like a Power Mac G4 or something because he wanted to play video games. That was his reason for using computers. My reason for using computers was to have an iTunes library. Right. So I don't have an iTunes library that dates all the way back to the first iTunes like library I ever created, but I do have like metadata from 2004. So I still have in some form the iTunes library that I created on that laptop. How I managed to preserve them through all of the like awful things that Apple has done to iTunes since, including adding iCloud Music Library and like destroying metadata that was created over that long of a time, I have no idea. But
and we'll get to Apple Music. We'll get to iCloud Music Library soon because that's the impetus for this entire conversation. But before we get there, I'm actually curious to know. So you've always loved music, right? Like this isn't like
Yes. You
downloaded Napster one day and you were like, oh my gosh, this is beautiful. You had a love for music and that love for music transferred over to this ability to have as much music as you wanted to, which is incredible, still is incredible that that's a possibility.
Yes.
What was music listening like pre-computer for you? Was this CDs and, you know, like just going to the record store and buying one on occasion?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure I had one cassette Walkman that I probably was given by my parents who bought one when it came out and realized they never walking around the world listening to music on headphones was not something that they cared to do or ever did. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I don't know why, but one of them gave me a Walkman, I'm pretty sure is what happened. That was later replaced by definitely Sony Discman. I can remember I had a black normal Sony Discman. That was my second one. So I was carrying around a CD and headphones. That eventually was probably supplemented by a wallet of, you know, 12 or 24 CDs that I could throw in a backpack. You know, I wasn't like listening to music in class, but I was definitely listening to music on, you know, like in the park across the street from school in middle school. It was iPod life before there was iPod life. And I was getting CDs. I was probably getting like $20 a week in allowance. And I was definitely spending that on a CD every week for much of my like middle school life. I remember this must have been into the MP3 era, but before the iPod era. I remember finding out that there was there were Discman players that could play MP3s off of data CDs, CDRs, and knowing exactly what that meant and being like, I have to have another Discman right now, and like getting one and then being able to put, you know, 8 or 10 full length albums on one CD in MP3 format. And then I only had to carry one CD around. And then it practically was like a small iPod, you know?
That could not be changed.
No, but like, why would I do, like, you know, I could have my Led Zeppelin CD and my System of a Down CD and my Offspring CD and whatever it is. And I had all of the songs by those bands with me all the time. Yeah. And it was just a matter of which disc I wanted in there. So, you know, that was into the MP3 era, which means it must have been into the iTunes era, which was probably comprised entirely of ripping CDs. And it was around this time, middle school, high school, that I found musician forums, and that dramatically expanded the music I was exposed to, which dramatically increased my appetite for new music. And of course, in the late 90s, you couldn't satisfy a voracious appetite for music without godless amounts of money.
Right.
Then, you know, and then Napster was sometime around then. I remember getting on Napster and looking for like songs I wanted to hear, being pretty thrilled they were there, but not really being impressed with what I was able to do, looking for more solutions, and probably on musicians forums finding out about Soulseek as this peer-to-peer thing where you add friends, mm-hmm. and you search the libraries of all of your friends on Soulseek, and whoever has it, you establish a peer-to-peer connection and download files. And so the brilliant thing about the way that Soulseek was designed was that it had chat rooms that were about all kinds of things.
I forgot about those.
Oh, man. You were on Soulseek too?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It was so good. So, like, I mean, I didn't hang out in the chat rooms.
No.
What I did was join the chat rooms with thousands of people in it that were music related, and then add all of the people with thousands of files,
right.
as friends.
Yes.
And then quickly I was able to find basically anything I could possibly be searching for, and, you know, leave it downloading overnight and have it in the morning.
This was dial-up.
DSL.
Yeah, dial-up-ish internet speeds.
And this carried on. This was the same pattern of behavior that carried on into my freshman year of college with college level, 2005 college level internet connections.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember being excited about getting onto the local network in the dorm and then seeing all the iTunes libraries. At the time, there were pretty trivial ways to rip music over the network from shared iTunes libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And that proved not to be nearly as fruitful as this amazing internet resource of Soulseek libraries that I had access to at the time. By then, I had found music libraries on Soulseek that were so bountiful that I would crawl through them one artist at a time, trying stuff.
Yeah.
You know, some people organize their files by genre in folders in there, and that would make it, a field day. But even people who were just alphabetical, who were, you know, which revealed usually that they were iTunes users, I would just like keep a text file running of like how far I had gotten in so-and-so's music library and just keep going and going.
Mm-hmm.
One way of doing this that I skipped over kind of, which was still very much going on in college, was just external hard drives, just, you know, taking people's entire iTunes libraries and you know, going through one at a time. And sometimes these were more interactive, really fun gatherings where you would go through and listen to stuff and people would say, oh, yeah, this is cool. And then you would give them that. And then, you'd go back and forth. So swapping huge amounts of music, both online and, over USB or FireWire, even, because that was way faster, was how I used primarily what I used computers for at the time.
Yeah.
You know, I guess it's, I fast forwarded through the era of having an iPod. I always had the highest capacity iPod, and that changed everything. And for a long time, the highest capacity iPod was 160 gigabytes. And that for a while represented an impossible ceiling, a ceiling I would never reach. So I didn't ever have to worry about how much music I had. And then I had 160 gigs of music, and for a very long time, I decided to use that as an upper limit and cull my library down by listening to stuff that I hadn't heard or that I'd rated low or whatever, and throwing it away if it wasn't good until I could fit it on 160 gig iPod again. And that became the constraint that lasted for a really long time until 256 gig phones came out. And now the sky's the limit again.
Why is it that music was the thing that everyone remembers downloading illegally. Hmm. I guess the answer that immediately comes to mind is, of course, a file size issue, right?
Yeah.
Movies were less attainable to rip and also way less attainable to download, because downloading a massive movie file is not as easy as a, I actually don't even know the size of an MP3, but a so-and-so megabyte MP3.
It's like a megabyte a minute.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So a 3 or 4 megabyte MP3, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that makes sense to me, but it does feel like it's this weird hidden origin story for a lot of people about how they really got onto the internet in the first place.
Yeah.
And it's weird because it's kind of hard to talk about because it is blatantly illegal. But at the same time,
I think we're past the statute of limitations at this
exactly.
point.
And I mean, I can't think of many people who don't have a memory of having downloaded Napster or SoulSeek or Kazaa or any of the other file sharing.
Yeah, I tried LimeWire. I tried LimeWire. Those ones too.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, I when you brought this up, I pulled up my phone and Googled it because I wanted to remember what the SoulSeek icon looks like, which is this little bird.
Yeah, the little snowman. Oh yeah, well the Mac client was called, that was called SoulSeek with an X at the end for OS X, presumably was the little snowman.
You had the snowman, I had the bird, and I just want to point out that SoulSeek, according to what I just looked at, still exists.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. That's so cool. Yeah, I should get back on there. You know what? I'm going to do that. When we get off this call, I'm going to try and find a client and like just go back to it, because like because I'm rebelling against the way that music works these days after trying it.
That's what I want to talk about here, right? Which is that example of what it was like for you to download music and look through it and have this sort of unending stream of new music sounds very utopian, and it mm-hmm. kind of is, right? Like
yeah.
there weren't many downsides to that system. There were downsides to the ways that we could listen to it, I guess. It wasn't awesome having to like burn CDs, although that did get pretty easy towards the end of that time period when you could put a ton of songs on a CD or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was a late adopter to the iPod, so I had like weird third-party music MP3 players that were like totally mm-hmm. crappy and like really horrible to load music onto, you know, and metadata, even though I think that you are somebody who meticulously made all of that look good, was not always
great. Every time I downloaded something, the what I would do is like load it up and clean up the metadata yeah. before I even listened to
because some of that was pretty out there, pretty bad, some bad album art or missing album art or wrong run times or weird stuff like that.
Yeah,
but all of that to say that utopia, that music utopia, is not the way that people consume music anymore. It's changed.
Speak for yourself.
Well,
man.
Okay. But how many people would I have to poll to find somebody that had a Napster alike on their computer these days? You know, it's unheard of.
Yeah. I don't use any of those like ambient logged in peer-to-peer services anymore, but I would be lying if I didn't say I check Pirate Bay for albums from time to time.
Yeah. And so it's changed from that to torrents, but after torrents came the streaming giants and, you know, Apple Music, Spotify, Google Play, I think is what it's called. You know,
I think they've tried it a couple times.
Amazon Music or whatever that Prime Music, something, you know.
Yep.
What I'm saying is that you can't go far without finding a streaming service. Odds are you're accidentally subscribed to a streaming service without knowing it. If you have Amazon Prime, you have that. If you have YouTube, you have Google Play. Like there's, and of course, yeah, speaking of YouTube, I mean, every song in existence kind of feels like it's on YouTube, just ready to be watched as a video, right, inexplicably, which is such a strange place for all of the world's music to have ended up, a video platform. But here we are, right? So the days of people filling an iPod with their music that was on their hard drive feel like they're now in the past. And you have been someone who has been living that reality still. Do you have an iPod?
I have two iPod Classics, but I'm not using them.
You're not using them. How long ago did you use it? I feel like it wasn't that long ago.
A year or two. I mean, no, it wasn't. The iPhone 8 was the first phone I ever bought that had enough space for all my music on it.
Exactly. So basically, here's what I'm saying, is that the average person had music on their hard drive, then had music on an iPod, then swapped that iPod out for an iPhone, and then swapped that hard drive music out for streaming music. And that's just kind of the way. Like, that's just been what's happened. But you, my friend, have not allowed for that to happen in your own life, and all that music still sweetly downloaded on a hard drive somewhere.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of it.
And backed up many, many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not to say that I've never subscribed to a streaming service.
Of course,
on the contrary,
yeah.
I didn't until Beats was acquired by Apple.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, for some reason, that seemed like enough of a vote of confidence in their taste that I then subscribed to Beats Music. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was even that, like, that leaked before the acquisition happened. Whatever it was, there was a period of time, a long period of time, when Beats Music seemed like a safe service to use because it was going to be integrated into Apple's world. And I guess maybe the other thing I was thinking was, like, all my listening history, all of my music habits of my entire life are in my iTunes library. And so why would I ever want to contribute to why would I want to split my music listening practices between different databases? So as soon as Beats Music became like this potential Apple product, that seemed like a safe bet to supplement the listening that I was doing to my local music library. And then, of course, it was integrated into Apple Music. And then I was an Apple Music subscriber for a brief period of time and then quit in disgust. But then not that long ago, actually resubscribed to Apple Music, but to use it as a completely separate subscription, like just for streaming stuff that doesn't touch my library at all. To the point that on iOS, I use a really, I don't know what I would do without this app. There's a music app called Cesium that is basically just like an old school iTunes interface to your local music library that, you know, you can configure to behave the way you would want it to if you curated your own library. And so that's what I have on my home screen. And like, if I want to listen to something that I don't have, I keep Apple Music so that it's extremely easy for me to do that.
Right.
So I can use the Shazam features if I'm like in a store and I hear a song I like. But when I go to listen to music, I'm putting on a file that I might have had since I was 14 years old.
Is that common, like in your friend group? Do you have a lot of people that listen to music the same way that you do?
Yeah, I was always the guy with the craziest library.
Right.
But that period of time of external hard drives going around, I had a lot of friends who were into that in high school and in college. And so I became sort of, because of being on this forum and also starting to read Pitchfork when that happened, because Pitchfork became a blog that was a source of new music, and Pitchfork reviews made it into musician forums every time they came out as a thing to discuss. I became sort of someone who knew when stuff was coming out and also introduced people to new music. And nobody was as judicious about their library, like, you know, hygiene as I was. But most of my friends had thousands of songs for sure, even the ones who didn't have iPods.
But do they still?
I think a lot of them do, but I think they might be in disrepair. I mean, my brother does. My brother still uses his iPod. Mm. He did just get an iPhone 8, and he considered getting a large one to fit his music. I think he might have gotten 128, actually. So like maybe he does keep a lot of music on it. But yeah, he carries his iPod around. My dad still has a local music library, although he is an Echo user and Spotify subscriber, so he might be doing most of his listening on Spotify. My wife has a large iTunes library, but is also doing all of her listening on Spotify. It's definitely uncommon to care as much about it as I do in my circles, but a lot of people I know still have local music libraries, whether they listen to them frequently or not.
I don't think that I know anybody that does have one, John. Like, I think that that's something that's shifted quite a bit. And it feels to me, and I know that this is an overgeneralization, but it feels to me like that's something for the olds. Like, you know, it just feels like something that feels almost dated at this point.
That's adorable. That's a really adorable thing to say. I mean, like, I'm so condescending of that idea. And like, now this is a separate question entirely from actual taste in music. Like, I will stand up and celebrate the oldness of my music tastes. But that the technological aspect of how I listen to music, I am so much more versed in the technology of music than like people who just sort of take whatever these corporate rental services give them. Like I'm doing things with devices that would blow the minds of young people. The For the Olds trope is for things that are technologically regressive. And I would argue that my practice is more technologically advanced, and the reason why people don't do it is laziness.
Well, exactly. And I think that that's something that's interesting here, right? Is that it's very similar to what's happened with video streaming, which is it was very easy to find anything you wanted to on a torrent if you wanted to watch a TV show or a movie a few years ago.
Yeah.
And then as Netflix and Hulu and these other giants started putting a bunch of video catalogs on their streaming services, it seemed like the torrents dried up. And then the Netflix library dried up. And now there are tons of videos, tons of movies, tons of shows that I would love to be able to watch, and they just don't exist anywhere except maybe iTunes for purchase or Amazon for purchase. And that's certainly people that have, like, let's say a Plex server with a ton of movies on it are having a much better streaming experience than someone who's signed up and subscribed for Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime Video. That is a subpar experience, but it's way easier to pay a few bucks a month for these services and browse around until you find something.
Yes.
Which, again, it's the exact same thing. Spotify, Apple Music, whatever you have. It's way easier to pay that money and see if the song is there. And if it's not there, nah, whatever. You can listen to another song. But somebody who has a rigorously controlled library is probably having the better experience here.
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly say so. And I know what songs are there. There's so many issues here. The availability of music is certainly one of my concerns. And I would estimate about 50% of my library is available on streaming services. Now, my library is 27,128 songs, weighing in at 153.16 gigabytes of space. And I'm telling you that almost 15,000 of those songs are not available on streaming services.
It's quite a few.
The reason is because my music tastes through the years of, you know, high school and college hipsterness into like actual ethnomusicology student. I have ripped CDs from the ethnomusicology libraries at Berklee College of Music in Boston. You know, like that stuff is not available for sale anymore, let alone for streaming. And some of it was even like burned CDs from, you know, studies, like they weren't released.
Right.
A lot of this music was never released at all. Much of the music that I have that I care about is never going to be available from any other source. So my library is the source. But I also have to be honest with myself. I'm also much less curious about new music than a lot of people are. Not new music in the abstract sense. Like I'm always interested in hearing music I've never heard before. But the kind of music being produced by the industry that produces music is basically of no interest to me. And so if you want to tell me my music habits are for the olds, like that's the way in which you're absolutely right. Like there's nothing for me in the For You section of any of these services.
Even Apple Music.
It's okay. I mean, I don't, I get much more of my music these days from people who I follow on Bandcamp, especially those whose labels are on Bandcamp, because those labels will send out promos for other artists on the label that I've never heard.
Mm.
Bandcamp is actually the source of where most of my music purchases come from these days. In fact, when I find something that I like, whether it's on Apple Music or anywhere, I will always check Bandcamp first before buying it on iTunes. Buying it on iTunes is sort of a last resort.
Mm.
There are a few reasons for that, but the main reason is that Bandcamp is the only company selling digital music as a middleman. Artists who sell music direct, I always do that. But Bandcamp is the only middleman that is promoting the kind of music business that I care to support. And it matters dearly to me that Bandcamp still exists, because it's like selling MP3s that you can do whatever you want with. And it's enabling artists to continue making music into that paradigm, instead of just getting paid like two shavings of a penny anytime anybody listens to their song on a music rental service, right, which is the term I'm going to keep using.
Yeah, I think that's about fair.
Hi, Internet friends. It's John here. Internet Friends is brought to you by my work at Ablaze Interactions, where I solve communication problems for clients who work to repair our world. I can help with information architecture to transform your website, content strategy to tell the right story and reach the right audience, and writing and editing to find the authentic voice of your company or organization, your product, or your idea. Ablaze Interactions has consulted for world-renowned events, political candidates, law firms, nonprofits, and great apps on the App Store. Light up your ideas. Go to ablaze.co and let me know if you're interested in working together. So you raised an interesting question at the beginning of this conversation about why music versus movies. And I think you partially answered it yourself with the bandwidth thing, but I think there is more to it than that. You also did raise the example of Plex people, mm-hmm. which I think is a demonstration that there's people doing the same thing with movies and TV as I'm doing with music.
Right.
It's interesting to note that I'm like not interested in doing that with Plex, you know, and so that raises the sort of why music and not movies question in a different way. Because if I were a real movie nerd, I would have a Plex server with all my files on it. And I do actually have a lot of movies downloaded from, let's say, elsewhere other than storefronts. But I don't really have a good library of those, and I don't really have a good workflow for watching those. If it does come time to watch one of those, I will do some sort of laborious conversion so that I can AirPlay it to my TV. The answer to all of that does boil down to something about the experience, like one essential thing, which is, sure, I revisit movies. There are several movies that I will watch over and over again over the course of my life. But the way that music fits into your life, it's the most portable, immersive experience that we've created for ourselves as an art form. Not music per se, but just sound. Like, because, you know, you and I are here creating another version of that. The fact that music can come with you means that the music that you find for particular kinds of moments in life can be at hand always whenever you're in that kind of moment. And you end up with songs that you hear dozens and dozens and dozens of times. And music matters that much to me that I would want to have that all of that music available for any situation where it's right at a moment's notice, and no algorithm is going to be able to determine which track it's going to be. And I don't need assistance with that. I've had this music for so long that I know what's in there. And it's almost like an exercise or mm-hmm. a practice to be able to encompass all 27,000 of these songs, like to know what's there, instead of just sort of saying, whatever, it's out there somewhere. The algorithm will remind me, you know, like I take pride not just in the library itself, but in sort of my ability to choose my own background music without needing the help of some for-profit entity. That is a function of what music is for. I do think it's particular to music. I wouldn't do this with podcasts. There are some podcasts that I archive that I want to make sure that, you know, if my kid grows up a certain way and would be someone who would like this show, I want to be able to give it to them,
yeah,
regardless of whether it's still available online. But that's not the same thing. I'm not going back to old episodes of Roderick on the Line and listening to them.
I think that you're totally correct that music plays a very interesting functional life in people's lives. But I think that that actually explains why people have been happy with the shift to streaming, because people on the whole are more likely to want an algorithm to decide that for them than for themselves. People that want to play a workout playlist, I don't think typically want to create that playlist themselves. They want a playlist made for them that sounds good and that they'll like, and that maybe will change every so often so they don't get bored of the songs.
Okay. I'll give you workouts. I'll give you yoga.
Certainly give me Christmas.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I'll give you any holiday right. you want. And these are the kinds of situations that I certainly use Apple Music for.
Mm-hmm.
If we're making tacos, I'm going to just yell at the HomePod and say, like, put on some Mexican music, and it's going to, like, completely guess wrong, but you know what I mean? I'm going to try.
Yeah.
But the algorithm doesn't know how you feel when the plane to back home is taking off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some of this different, some of this, like, because this is a really visceral thing for me. Like, the idea that I would turn to a recommendation to find what to listen to in that situation is, like, nauseating to me. This is not just like a consumer choice thing. This is like, I think people are wrong about this thing.
Right.
So it might be that it comes down to intentional lifelong habits about what you use music for. And, like, to me, there's so much sentiment in, like, that moment of the plane taking off to go back home that I've done so many times, and I can remember what I've listened to, like, on dozens of those flights from dozens of places. I'm contributing to a project of mine of finding the song that tells me the story of my own life there. And, like, Spotify doesn't know anything about that situation.
And it won't.
Yeah.
That's not going to change. Where maybe a HomePod will be able to put on some Mexican music at some point. It's not going to be able to understand and read your mind and create those situations.
Right.
Let me tell you a little bit about me at this point, which is I had the same experience as you did from the jump about Napster and SoulSeek and all of that. Had a voracious appetite for music. I think the difference between you and I is that my voracious appetite for new music, like, the emphasis is on the word new.
Yeah.
So I have always been interested in listening to something new. I very, very, very rarely want to go back and listen to something even a few months old. Mm. That just isn't the way that I listen to music. There are massive exceptions. I have a huge place in my heart for Prince. Mm. Both of my parents were, like, huge Prince fans, and I listened to him all the time growing up. And so there's a lot of nostalgia involved. And also, he's just an extremely good artist. And so I listen to old Prince music all the time. And, like, you know, there are times where I want to go back and remember an album that was really good, or there are albums that have nostalgia for me or put me in a place and I'd go back and listen to them. But on the whole, on the daily, what I listen to is something that just came out.
Mm-hmm.
And streaming music does help me way more in that regard, because that's what it seems custom built to do.
Sure.
Is show me the new music that just came out. And it doesn't really care about the stuff that came before it. And so that's, like, a difference, because I think that I so rarely want to look back on the things that I listened to in the past that I don't have this desire to cultivate this library of music. Because I think what I'm saying is I feel like what streaming music has done is not a great thing. It's made it feel a little more disposable because I don't have to pay $12 for an album. I'm paying $9 for a service. And so if I like the song or I didn't like the song, it didn't really matter because new songs are coming, period. Like, that's really all that matters.
That kind of says it all to me. And I'm not saying, when I say I think people are wrong, I'm not saying that desire is wrong. I'm not saying that the desire to hear the new stuff is wrong, and I'm absolutely completely agree that these services are the best way anyone has ever devised of making sure that people hear the new stuff. Mm-hmm. The thing I'm saying is wrong is that it doesn't matter exactly what song I put on in a given situation. The laziness that I'm describing, and I don't think that what you're describing is lazy. I think what you're describing is a different kind of appetite, an appetite for novelty. It's a searching. It's not just like, I'm going to sit here and you give me entertainment and I don't care what it is. It's a desire that seems insatiable from the way you describe it to, like, hear what's new. So what I want to ask you is, what do you love about hearing new music.
I really enjoy finding a sound that feels fitting of the time. And that is like how nostalgia works, right? An example of how I process music and like re-listen to it is every time that it gets cold out, I always put on Kanye West's Streetlights off of his album 808 and Heartbreak, because that song sounds like winter
to
me.
It's a good record.
It's a very good record. That song sounds like winter to me, and I have to put it on every time. And when I do, I remember the first time that I heard that. And that song still weirdly feels new, but also reminds me of that time period. Mm. And actually, I'm having the most fun I've had with music in years right now, because I own a physical coffee shop. And you know, your boy is making the physical coffee shop's playlists.
Right.
And it's so fun. I'm having such a good time subjecting people to my musical tastes.
That is really awesome. I'm very jealous.
It is. It is very fun. But all of those songs are brand new songs that mostly have come from my Spotify Discover Weekly. And Spotify mm-hmm. Discover Weekly, this algorithmic playlist that it builds for you every week, is like the best thing that I've experienced in music in a long, long time. Because it's interesting for me to hear that the playlists aren't working for you, because Spotify's knows me. And I would say that if it gives me 30 tracks a week, I'm going to think that like 23 or 24 of them are good enough to put in my library and listen to again.
Let me clarify. I'm not giving it a chance to work for me.
Mm, that's interesting.
I'm quite sure that if I use Spotify, Apple Music is just straight up not as good at this. If I were to use Spotify, I'm quite sure that I would have the same exact hit rate as you with new recommendations. The flip side of all the stuff I'm saying about my habits is that too high a volume of new music is impossible for me to digest. Because when I put on music that I've never heard before, I am making an assessment about whether I want this to be part of my library or not. And I am wrong sometimes, but I have gained complete faith in the fact that the record will come back around again through some mixture of random chance and social recommendations, and I will hear it again in the right place at the right time and then want it and keep it.
Hmm.
The album form is also another part of this problem. The thing I think people are most wrong about is the idea that we can dispose of albums now because of the way that our music listening works, that just like one song from one artist at a time forever is all we need, and artists can just go make one song in the studio and be done. Like, that is the thing I think is most wrong about the way the music industry is working right now, the single-driven way of working. And I realize that that's how it worked at the beginning, too.
Yeah.
And that the album is an anathema and an art... Well, sorry, that's not the word I meant. The album is an anachronism. It's an artifact of the period of time when corporate record labels realized they could make $20 a pop by packaging more music onto a large format thing that they had.
Which had a limitation of how large it could be.
Exactly. But the thing is, you know as well as anybody as a designer that constraints make art good.
I agree.
And it's my opinion that the artists who use the constraint of the long playing record, the artists who use the constraint of the long playing record to make great albums made the best music of all time.
Hmm.
And artists who emulate those artists and continue to make albums that create a full hour of experience are the ones that I care to listen to. So if I'm listening to a playlist of recommendations and I hear a song I like, the very next thing I'm going to do is go to the album that song is on and listen to that album starting on track one.
Yeah.
And if I don't make it through track one, I'm done.
Mm.
This creates an enormous bottleneck for like my ability to internalize a new artist. And it definitely has a breaking point. If I encounter a new artist that I love and that artist has 40 records, I'm in serious trouble because I'm going to need to listen to them all. And I'm going to need to decide which ones I want to keep and which ones I don't. But I love to do that. This is obviously something that nobody cares to do, but it's part of internalizing that artist into my own sort of palette of colors to paint with. And the album is the only way to see sort of the full spectrum of what a song means to me. So that's the way I have to do it. So getting inundated with recommendations of new music day in and day out would completely overwhelm me. And that's why I only dip into Apple Music every once in a while.
Speaking of Apple Music, this whole entire conversation has occurred because Apple Music did you real dirty, flipped a switch on its own that did some damage to this long-standing library of yours.
I'm actually impressed this time at the limit
of damage
of the scope of the damage.
Okay, good.
Because what happened the first time when Apple Music came out, I had been chafing at the 160 gigabyte limit that I had imposed on myself so that stuff would fit on my iPod. I was really interested in the idea of hosting my library on a cloud service. And I was optimistic about the idea that Apple was doing one, so it might work the way that iCloud Drive does, for example, where I can have my own local library of music and I can just pull it down to the devices that I want instead of syncing my iPhone and iPad over a wire with my Mac,
right.
Which is what I've been doing the whole time, entirely because of music. And iTunes Match was never for me because I knew that like half or more of my music wasn't available in the iTunes music store. So that would never have done it. But when iCloud Music Library was announced, I sort of got the impression that it was going to work the way I thought, which is it's going to take the iTunes Music Library on my Mac, which is a file I have backed up in five different places all the time. And I'm never worried about it being lost because of how carefully I've taken care of it for so many years. It's going to take that. It's going to put it into my personal cache of iCloud. Well, then they even said this doesn't count against your iCloud storage. I was like, sweet.
Right.
So, I imagined they were going to take that. They were going to host it in iCloud and that my iTunes on my Mac would upload things to that always. My metadata in my library would edit the metadata in that library and it would all be available on my iOS devices. And as was widely documented by many people, the first version of Apple Music was so horrible that it just completely, it deleted files. It didn't just like change, well, it did completely destroy my metadata, but it actually deleted the local versions of my music completely and replaced them with like locked Apple Music versions that I couldn't take out. So that was a complete unmitigated disaster. I nuked that iTunes Music Library from orbit and restored from my pre-Apple Music backup and never considered using iCloud Music Library again. But then I did later, as I said, turn Apple Music back on. But there is a switch that lets you keep iCloud Music Library off so that you just have a separate section for streaming and your library is your library. And not that long ago, I noticed that the genres, which is an essential form of metadata for me, I've made up most of my genres. I know exactly what's in each one. I know, if I think of an artist, I'm like, where is that artist? I know the answer because I have created these genres myself. The list of genres had changed and it included some stupid ones that like I knew were from the iTunes store. And when I looked at what was in there, I sort of thought, oh, this is Apple's music app being too aggressive, showing me the iTunes music store versions of these songs that I've purchased instead of my local versions. And eventually it got annoying enough to me that I went to my Mac to see what was wrong. And I found that the local versions had their genres changed. And that's when I looked at my preferences and saw that the iCloud Music Library switch had been toggled on. That was so, I mean, like I can't believe that Apple did this. Like Apple is my favorite technology company. That's not like so far from enough of a superlative to describe how important Apple is to me. We've talked about this in so many ways. I trust Apple with my entire mental and emotional, like outboard brain.
Right.
Like it is my life. And the fact that they would flip a switch like that because of a bug and secretly, subtly destroy a bunch of data that I have spent my entire life using their products to create was like the biggest breach of trust with Apple that I've had in ever. And I did then spend the afternoon fixing my genres. And I think I got everything. I mean, eventually I will see all of the problems. And then I will have cleaned it all out. And I'm back to normal, I think. But they're just slowly killing my ability to listen to music the way I want to. And this is probably why you're bringing this up, right? Is like, my days are numbered.
So you had messaged me that you were having this massive issue. And at the exact same time that happened, I had on the same day got an email from iTunes letting me know that my iTunes match was expiring unless I did something about it. And I did nothing about it. So I fell off the wagon here because I had a lot of music in iTunes Match that isn't available anywhere else. Specifically Prince related. Prince notoriously had tons of music that, well, forever while he was alive was not available on any streaming platform whatsoever. But then just tons of music that wasn't available, like for purchase or to listen to with your ears, unless you found it on a pirated website somewhere. And so because of that, I really had been keeping this iTunes Match library around. And over the years, I just stopped listening to it. I haven't even opened iTunes in forever. It kind of made sense when I used Apple Music, but now I use Spotify. And there just wasn't a place for me to have that anymore. And so I don't. And I'm curious to know what you think the future is going to look like for, one, music, two, your music library, and three, my music library. Because I feel like all of those answers have to converge at some point, but maybe they don't. I'm really not sure.
Well, it sounds like you've decided that the future of your music library is whatever is available on whatever service you're subscribed to.
I think that I'm okay with that because of the way that I listen to music. And that is kind of a fun thing about music, right? Is that it's so different for everybody.
Yeah.
I think I am not okay with the way that the video streaming libraries exist right now. They're annoying and it's a bummer. And I think I would rather just give my money to iTunes one movie at a time than to constantly be searching for what's available here. And it was like just recently that I was like, oh, Christine's never seen so-and-so movie. We should watch it. And then the next day I went to go watch it with her and it had like expired off the network or whatever, you know? And that's not the first time that kind of thing has happened to me. So, you know, that's a real bummer. But because of the way that I listen to music, I think that this works for me. The problem is I'm not sure if it works for musicians.
No. Yeah.
But neither did pirating music. So, you know, like that wasn't good for them either.
The problem with music piracy is that lots of kids with no money listen to music.
Yeah.
And they're probably the ones who care the most about it.
In the height of my music piracy phase, I probably bought the most music ever or things ever. There were a few bands that I really, really fell in love with, and I would just buy their vinyl records and put them on my wall. I would go to shows. I would buy shirts and different things like that, you know? And honestly, I haven't done any of that in a long time because I think that there was some sort of feeling of absolution that I got when I would buy merch.
Yes. And oh, I'm very familiar with that feeling.
And I don't feel like I need that anymore because I'm quote unquote paying for it. Of
right.
course, you know, the artists aren't necessarily seeing that money, but that's how it feels to me. So I think it actually might be worse.
Maybe if you set all of the song, if you take every device in your house and you put one song on repeat on all of those devices and leave it on all the time, then you're paying for it.
Yeah, I actually did. I went to the gym recently and there was this one song that came on and it just was working for me. And so I put it on loop and I thought that's probably the first time that someone's seen money from me in a long time was this 2 minute song on loop for an hour that probably actually did something of some substance for somebody for the first time. Hello, internet friends. It's Drew. And I want to tell you about Key House. There's a quote from Kurt Vonnegut that I read, tucked away in an essay he wrote about the seasons, where he said that he thought that the idea of four seasons was a lie. Instead, we should have six. Fall doesn't move to winter, and winter doesn't move to spring. Instead, he thought the season should be like so. Summer, fall, locking, winter, unlocking, and spring. I believe there's a beautiful poetry to the idea that creation itself requires a time of unlocking before anything of substance can bloom. And perhaps you're listening to this message right now, stuck between what you're doing and what you want to do for the rest of your life, realizing that you might be in that cruel season of unlocking too. Find your own space for unlocking. Go to Keyhouse, KEYHOU.SE, and let's find the key.
The thing I'm most interested in about Apple Music as a product is the fact that it's the only Apple product with usernames with at symbols in front of them, you know? And like, I don't know what that means. I don't know what they're going to do. The way that Apple talks about music is the reason that I still have enough confidence to keep trying their music products, even though they keep destroying my library, because they know that music is a social force that brings people together and creates literal and figurative harmony among people. And, you know, the fact that they would come out with a product like the HomePod that no one understands proves to me that they think of music as a value to humanity.
Yeah.
Like it's, and you know, this event that they just had at the music school and all that, like they're putting so much weight behind music that it makes it feel like, oh, and giving away GarageBand. I mean, come on, like the signal that Apple is sending about music is music matters to human beings, and like computers are the best thing to ever happen to music. And I think that statement is true. And maybe the implied step three is Apple is the best thing to ever happen to computers, especially vis-a-vis music. And I think that's also true. The question I have about Apple Music, and I think this is, I don't mean to harp on Apple. I think you could expand this to be about any streaming service, because I think Spotify has obviously really great community features. The question I think this poses about streaming music going forward is, can the streaming service as home, as musical home, be a community space the way that musical spaces have always been community space? And I think it really matters a lot for how valuable streaming music is to people. Because you use the word disposable to describe sort of the idea that the songs can come and go. It doesn't really matter. It's just like a stream of new experiences. But it's only disposable, truly disposable, if people don't care about those experiences. And if the experience of being on the internet streaming music with many thousands of others and getting recommendations from them and, you know, seeing what they're listening to, if that experience creates community around music, it's going to be valuable no matter how you listen. And like, I sure do hope that like those services always give you the ability to pin music into some kind of library for yourself that's like separate from the stream. But like, I would certainly participate in that if like streaming music clearly became a way to be together online. It does it feel like that at all to you as someone who uses it more than I do?
Spotify doesn't care about community at all, and that's a real bummer. Where Ardio, the platform I used beforehand, did. And I think that part of that is because, at least right now, music is, to me, so deeply personal that that's the way that streaming music platforms are handling this. But that's what I miss about RDO, was the ability for me to see what other people were listening to. And even right now, as I said before, I've been creating these playlists to play in Evergreen, the coffee shop, and you can, I guess, follow them, but it's like really hard and it's like very confusing. And even like the names, the usernames on Spotify aren't easy. Like the name for Evergreen's account is actually some inexplicable string of numbers.
You can't like go to the profile by a URL that has the name.
No, like it says Evergreen, but like that's not the actual profile name that like Spotify sees. It's very confusing and very terrible and uneditable. So that's not what Spotify seems to care about in the slightest. And I mean, also, let's say that one of these did have amazing community features like RDO did. It's still a bit of a bummer because not everybody is on the same platform. So,
right.
You know, that's like I was just thinking, oh, you know, after this, I'll send a link to John so that he can see this playlist that I've been creating. But of course, you can't listen to it because it's on Spotify and not Apple Music. And, you know, these things, they're going to need to be figured out before community can really be incorporated back into the music world, I feel like. I'm glad that you brought up the fact that albums are both an anachronism and a powerful artistic statement at the same time, because I definitely think that they're both. I'm not sure if that's the path forward for most music, but for much music, gosh, I sure hope that that albums exist going forward, because, you know, if you have something to say and it takes you an entire album, that's like such an incredible length, you know, this hour of music, you know, as a full beautiful statement. But yeah, what is your dream? What is your realistic dream of how music's going to look like going forward?
Well, frankly, the album is my standard. If you're not interested in making a full-length album of your feelings, I'm not going to listen. I mean, I'll listen once maybe, but like I'm not going to care. I'm not going to be able to invest, so I'm not going to listen. So there may be two music industries, and one is all about singles and one is all about like big dense works that most people won't listen to.
It's interesting.
But I listen to enough artists who put a year into making a record and then sell the record for $15, and $15 is like thousands and thousands and thousands of Spotify plays, right? So like it's I mean, maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but you know, it's so much more possible for independent artists who have direct relationships with fans to make money $15 at a time than it is to make money on singles, that I have faith that that's going to be that the way that the music is going to continue to work for the truly great indie labels and indie artists is that they're going to make music an hour at a time, sell it for $15, and then you're going to go to the show to see that music live and pay $50. And I'm fully on board and fully living that life, and I am not worried about any of those artists going broke. And that's good enough for me. And there may only be 20 of them in my life, but I'm along for the ride for their life, and they for mine at this point, because of the way I listen to music. So, you know, I will go back and listen to the record from 1997 when I'm feeling that way, and I will excitedly buy the new one and listen to it immediately. And like, that's the relationship I have with those artists. And lots of them are on Bandcamp. The ones that are big enough are selling direct downloads from their websites. And, you know, if I gotta buy it on iTunes, I'll buy it on iTunes. And that's enough new music for me, is my point.
Yeah.
And it's maybe more than enough. I may still like be finding out about albums that bands I love made years later, for the rest of my life, even as it is. Yep. So I'm not worried about that. As far as the technology for being able to listen to music this way, I'm actually sort of looking forward to the day that iTunes gets killed and Apple completely. I mean, I don't really know what they're going to do. I don't really know if they would take the local music library out of the iOS music app or something. They've still never made a way to add music to it other than buying it on iTunes, which funnily enough causes all kinds of havoc for the music library the way that I have it set up. If I buy something on iTunes from my phone or from my iPad, I end up with and then I sync my library to that device, I end up with two copies of the song, one local with the right metadata and one like cloud version, and like the every song on the album is doubled, so I have to like wipe it and sync it over again in order to fix that problem. So, you know, I can't buy iTunes music on iOS devices is the bottom line. But we're in this horrible in-between period for Apple as far as what their music apps do, and I sort of look forward to the point at which local music is not managed by a first party app at all. As long as I still have the ability to put files in folders on my devices, I'll be fine. And I have some confidence that there will be iOS apps that can look at that and play it as a music library. Once that's allowed according to App Store rules, that just depends on Apple changing the rules. Like right now, you can't have a music app that has its own library.
Yeah.
The only kinds of music apps you can have are ones that access your phone's local music store through the public APIs. That's what Cesium does, and it works perfectly. Now, just as of last week, they released a new update that's fully API safe and supports all the iOS 12 stuff and the AirPlay 2 and all of that. And so now there is an app that works exactly the way I will want my music app to always work for the rest of my life. It just looks at the local iTunes music store and hope or storage, not the store. And hopefully, if Apple does ever kill that feature of its own music app, you'll be able to just use third-party apps, and that's what I'll do. And streaming, I will probably still keep streaming as a separate app. I also have the Bandcamp app installed because listening to the stuff I've found on Bandcamp through that app by streaming it is sometimes like the quickest way to find something. So, you know, I'm okay with having multiple music services. I just, that library is going to come with me until the apocalypse and there's no more computers.
Okay. One more question, which is this: picture that John that was first downloading that SoulSeek client, right?
Yeah.
And take that computer away from him. Well, take that SoulSeek download away from him and instead have him open up like Spotify. Do you think that having streaming services at that time, at that formative time in your life, would have changed the way that you saw music and even technology?
Yes, obviously. You got me. Like, if that had been the aperture into which I could find music, that is how I would have done it. And I don't know, I still would have, like, assuming that I still had the same musical encounters I had, I would still have come across situations where I would find out about an artist and they would be a totally DIY thing that I wouldn't be able to stream. Mm-hmm. Or I would be in a class and I would find out about some form of classical music that has no, you know, commercial releases. And I would, like, you know, from Java or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And I would not be able to stream that. And I don't know what I would do, but I guess what I would probably do is put it in the Finder, you know, yeah, and like play the songs one at a time or I'm sure there would be apps for that and I would keep them separate and I wouldn't have this attachment to the library. The fact is Apple created this monster that is me by giving me iTunes.
Well, the internet did in a weird way, right? Because I very, very vividly remember my music collection pre-internet. And it was a single stack of CDs that was no longer than my arm's width, right? And the internet completely changed that, where all of a sudden, one, these things didn't have to be physical anymore, which was always a major, bottleneck. And two, I didn't need to worry about its size at all. I could just keep downloading forever. And I think that in me, it instilled a bit of a disposable nature of music. And in you, it instilled this really big understanding of a library. Like, you know, you have created a literal library. Like, you know, you probably have history mm-hmm. in that library that people that have a streaming, library don't. And by the way, like, I know that you haven't really used Spotify. The library, quote unquote, in Spotify is horrible. Like, it is not easy to find a song.
Yeah.
It was way, way easier to do that kind of stuff in iTunes than it is currently for me. But that's because the library has been devalued and it doesn't seem to be the thing that people care about anymore.
Yep.
But that is something that was really important to you. And it still is. And I'm not sure that's like a bad thing. I think that's really, really interesting.
Damn right. It's not a bad thing. The initial conditions were actually different though, the way that you just described it. Like my stack of CDs, I had a rack of CDs. I was 14 years old with 50 CDs and it was already going to be a problem. and then when iTunes got the ability to rip CDs, mm-hmm. that was what did it. I was like, oh, it's over.
Yeah.
Now the CDs can be disposable.
Yeah, right.
And because the songs that are immortal are going to be here.
Yeah.
and I don't have to, carry this crap around anymore. So like the library existed before I had the computer.
Well, then it sounds like you are somebody that always would have been somebody that cared about having a big library. And I guess the question for me then is what happens to people like you in this time where music has become less and less about the archival purposes of it, which is truly a big bummer. This is to again parallel it to video. I think that this last week or so marked the death of Filmstruck, this big, awesome streaming channel that basically was the only place for people to watch movies of a certain kind, especially older. And the network obviously didn't have big enough numbers to continue existing, so the plug got pulled. And now there just isn't anywhere to watch A, B, C, D, or E. These things have disappeared off the internet. And I would wager that if I wanted to listen to some of the music in John's library, the only place to do it is John's library. And I mean, you said that about like, yeah, it's not on Apple Music. But I mean, like, would it even be possible for me to like find it to download somewhere? You know, maybe not for some of this stuff because it's changed.
In a lot of cases, definitely not. Because it was like burned on a CD by the anthropologist who recorded it.
Yes, exactly.
But even so, like, or it was made in a garage and sold on USB sticks by weird bands in Providence. You know, like that's not ever going to be there. And because I'm not on SoulSeek anymore, you're not going to be able to find it that way. But maybe that'll change.
And post SoulSeek and Kazaa and pre Pirate Bay, or like at the same time as Pirate Bay, there were a couple of private torrent trackers that were doing big, big numbers. I remember one of them was called like Oink, and they were these invite only places that had anything you wanted. And I remember that when Oink died, people were freaking out because they were like, you've just killed history.
Yeah.
You know, it was, oh, there's something going on outside. It was obviously killed because it was illegal, but there was stuff there that wasn't anywhere else. And I, you know, this is the weird place that we're in, right? And this is like, to me, the awkward part of the phase that we're currently in is that we are making music more available and we're also encouraging people to make it more, but we're not making it easier to store or find or preserve.
Well, we're making it easier to store. My phone is 512 now. If I doubled my music library over the next few years, it would withstand Spotify going away. It would withstand being offline in the mountains. It would withstand being underground on the subway or up in the air in an airplane, and it would always be there. It's stored and it's available. That part's easy. The capacity of these devices has, I would say, already outstripped any dream of being able to fill them with music. And that's only going to change. That's only going to get more exponential because, you know, it's being driven by the camera. You know, the video that you're shooting on your device is what's driving the capacity upwards, and music fans can rejoice. There are many senses in which it's never been a better time. There's never been a better time to listen, to be an adoring archivist of music, technologically. But the commercially available ways of accessing new music don't work the way that the ways of archiving and storing and curating and caring about your own personal music do. And if I can never download another MP3 again, I'll be fine. And like according to iTunes, if I press play at the top right now, it would go for 86.7 days before it repeated. I could be done at any time. It's so much music, and yet it's such a tiny fraction of how much music is available on streaming. But you have convinced me that there is a genuinely intellectually and emotionally and artistically curious way to be all in on streaming, which is to say every day, I wonder what is out there that I haven't heard yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you posed that example of like, what would 16-year-old John do if presented with Spotify? I mean, I would have had that attitude at that time. Yeah. The thing is, it was like a new continent opened up before me of like undiscovered musical country. And I explored the boundaries and borders and climbed the mountains and spelunked through all the caves. and found treasure and brought it back home. And now I'm rich in musical wealth. Mm. And like, I don't feel the need to acquire any more of it. And that's just what happened. Mm. I don't expect that to ever happen again for people coming up now. Like, I don't think that's how music works anymore in a fundamental way. But I'm not saying that people who have access to streaming music aren't rich in music. I'm saying that the music that I've found and kept through the course of my life is priceless to me.